And we'll take your phone calls with David Icke this hour on Coast to Coast AM. So we're taking baby steps now, David, but what about the possibilities of a false flag? Some event, something contrived, created to keep pushing this even further?
Oh, I think that's a certainty, because the effect of that, as we saw with 9/11, if people are unaware of the background to it and accept the official story of these contrived events on face value, then that again justifies the imposition of more and more of this agenda. And the happenings in Georgia were another move in this agenda of fear and ratcheting up the journey to more conflict between major powers, and that was completely contrived. I mean, Georgia is one of many 51st states of the United States, and of course the president of Georgia, Shaakis Vali, was a front man and is a front man for the American regime. The Rose Revolution, which was a supposedly people's revolution that put him into power effectively, he was part of that, was funded by people like George Soros, the very infamous financier. And what part of that money was used to train large numbers of students in Georgia in the art of civil resistance and protest, and it brought the sitting regime down. And so there's no way. I mean, I read in response to the Georgia conflict, things like, they must have been crazy. Surely they knew that what the Russians would do. Yes, of course they did. Of course they did. It's not about sides. It's about an outcome. And so when South Ossetia was targeted, of course the Russians were going to respond as they did. That was the idea.
They had to. They had no choice, right?
Yeah, well, you know, Shaakis Vali is just a puppet. I mean, you know, he wouldn't cough loudly without permission from across the Atlantic. And I've also seen, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, that Putin was kind of the good guy in this, and the Russians were the government were the good guys in this. You know, the Russian bear gives a slap to the American, you know, manipulators. Masks on the same face, I would say. At the level of the Bushes and the Clintons and the Putins, yeah, they might fight among each other because, you know, these people do. I mean, they all want their own level of power on the greasy pole. But there are levels above them that when any infighting gets out of hand in terms of the agenda, they've got their heads banged together and they know the consequences. They're pawns in the game as well. And what we're seeing is little movements and on the chessboard towards this this global conflict that has long been planned. So on that road to more justification of Orwellian impositions of destructions of freedom and to that conflict, we're going to see endless false flag events, large and small, that are behind the scenes manipulated to create the outcome. And the outcome is always more centralization of power, more conflict, more divide and rule, more fear among the population. So we're going to have loads of those things.
And more lives of good, hardworking soldiers and people.
Yeah, well, the thing is that one of the aspects of this whole reptilian thing, if you like, is that this hybrid DNA does not seem to have the ability to manifest empathy. This is really, really important. I mean, we have
there's no emotion there, is there?
No, we have the reptilian brain, the R complex, the oldest part of the human brain, which the scientists call the R complex reptilian brain. And from there, we get one of the things that we get is cold, what we would term cold-blooded behavior. But of course, there are other parts of us that balance that out. If you are much more focused and coming from that level of reality, of course, these traits of the reptilian brain are going to have much more impact, or you're much more powerful in your behavior and your sense of perception and what's right and wrong and all the rest of it. And one key thing that is so obvious to me after all these years of research is that these bloodlines that end up in the positions of power, they have an almost impossible ability to manifest empathy. Now, empathy is the fail-safe mechanism of human behavior. If I have empathy with the consequences of for others of my actions, then I will then be much more likely to change my actions, because I am having an emotional consequence for my actions in seeing the effects on others. Take that away, George, and there are no limits. See, you talk quite rightly about the slaughter of the innocent and soldiers and all the rest of it, but to us, we could never orchestrate a 9/11. We could never lie to invade Iraq and bring about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dead and injured people and children. We couldn't do it because our empathetic response would not allow it and not even conceive it. But to these people, it's of no emotional consequence whatsoever, and therefore, you know, anything goes with these people. Yeah. It's very important to understand that, because as I say to people, if you perceive or think on the basis of what you would do and apply it to what these people would do, you've lost the plot.
We have a conscience.
Yeah, well, conscience is another way. Absolutely, conscience is another way of putting it. But it seems that on a computer level, on a body computer level, that it will not manifest empathy, and that's a really, really important thing to understand in terms of what these people will do that the general population would not.
Let's go to some calls. Mary Jo in Indiana, east of the Rockies. You're on with David Icke. Go ahead, Mary Jo.
Yes. Thank you. Hi, David.
Hello, Mary Jo.
Fan of yours forever, and I like what you're saying, and I know Kathy and Mark, they're friends of mine, and I was so pleased when you had Matthew Deluse on the show. He had, you printed a couple of things for him, but that is one wonderful man. He's heading in the right direction, and I read his Spitting Out the Feathers of the Ben-U Bird, and I sat there. It's a very long piece. It made more sense. So I wrote to him, and I said it was like an electric light going off or an atomic bomb in my head. I said there were so many answers that I didn't even know I was looking for particular answers, but in that paper that he wrote, and it was quite a long one, but I would suggest people take a look at Matthew Deluse. Look him up on the internet, and you'll find him. And he's put out several papers before, but he's adorable. He has a sense of humor, and he's very interesting. He's changed my way of thinking 120 degrees.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Matthew Deluse. I know Matthew. I've spoken to him on the phone quite a while ago now, but I've seen his stuff, and he's very, very good at picking out the deeper levels of symbolism and what's put around us in general everyday life, and the effect that those things have in a cold, calculated way in terms of the origin of why they do it that way, that speak to the subconscious and affect us and basically implant senses of reality into our mind on a subconscious level when it just appears to be a backing of a band on a stage or whatever. It goes into great detail and depth on how the world is put before us, which in a way that just looks like the world, but actually when you look deeper at it, these symbolic elements to it are speaking to the subconscious and programming us to see life and ourselves in a certain way. It's very, very good. I recommend it too.
Joe in Las Vegas, you're on with David Icke. Joe, go ahead.
Hello, yes. How are you?
Good.
All right, Joe. Yep.
Yeah, I was going to ask Mr. Icke if he has read the book En Route to Global Occupation by Gary Kaw.
No, I've not.
You haven't seen that? Well, he does a pretty good job about explaining who the controllers of the world are in that. But also, I wanted to tell you a couple of true stories and get your comment on them.
Okay.
I had a international I used to write an international newsletter, and I had a contact that worked for the Rothschilds. And and he told me the ownership of the Bank of America went, it's owned by an Irish common law trust, which is owned by another Irish common law trust, which is owned by a bank in Switzerland that is owned by the Rothschilds. And I don't know if you know about this, but anyway, if you look at the word Rothschild, it actually says Rothschild, which means red shield in German. And it's no coincidence. The real name of the Rothschild family is Bauer. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, yeah. I've written a lot about that in my books.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Maybe that's where I got it. Because I've read several of your books. But anyway, it's the House of Rothschild. And there's a lady that I used to have a man that worked for me. He was an engineering type. And he had a friend that lived in Italy. And in Italy, he was dating this lady that was a member of the Rothschild family. And the Italian people there around her wanted her to go to the Rothschild, Lord Rothschild up in England, see if she could get some funding to help the Holocaust victims there in Italy. And so she went up there, and she was having a meeting with Mr. Rothschild, and he was called out of the room during the meeting. And then in the next room, she heard voices. So she looked through this dumbwaiter, you know, how it opens up to serve stuff through a wall.
Uh-huh.
Well, she looked through the dumbwaiter, and Mr. Rothschild was taking instructions from a reptilian. This guy swears this is a true story all the way down. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, what you described in terms of the ownership of the Bank of America is absolutely classic. You know, when I talk about the few at the top of the pyramids controlling all within the pyramid, that's exactly how it works. If the name Rothschild or Rockefeller was officially on every bank, people would say, hold on a second, what's going on? So what they do is exactly the way you describe. They set up these trusts and these front organizations, and eventually when you go through them, you come to the real owners, and then you come for another bank, and you go through the same basic system, and you come to their owners, and they're the same owners as the other bank. That's the way it works. That's a very, very good description that you've just said. In terms of the reptilian thing and Rothschild, it comes up all the time. Talked about these, what from normal perspective, if you like, is a very extreme thing, shape-shifting reptilians and all this stuff, reptilian control. I've not done it. Someone's told me about a reptilian, so I'll say it's all the reptilians. This comes after decades of research, or at least 1.5 decades of research into this, in 46 countries, and the stories are endless from people of endless different backgrounds. And one, quite early on, was actually a banker in the Swiss banking industry who said that he had this big, he went to this big event. It was at a castle where it went on over a weekend. And he said there's this walkway. It was like a tunnel between two different parts of the castle. And he said that he was walking along this, and two of the Rothschilds were walking towards him, because they were very heavily involved in this financial conference, of course. And he said as they went past him, they looked human, although strange. They had a strange energy about them, he said. And as he went past them and turned and looked back, they weren't human anymore. It's a common theme. And what you've just described to me is something I've heard many, many times. You see, Bauer, they were a very... notorious occult family in the Middle Ages, and then eventually through Mayer Amstel Rothschild, they changed their name to Rothschild Red Shield after the symbol on their house in Frankfurt, where the whole dynasty started. But they are not just a banking dynasty; they are deeply, 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 deeply. I cannot stress enough. Deeply into what you might call Satanism or the occult black magic. Hmm. They're very, very skilled, and they go back a long time in that knowledge. And in the end, that's what it's about. black magic, if you want to call it that, is the negative use of knowledge that can also be used in a very positive way. And they are like casting a spell in a way. They're casting a spell on the human mind and therefore controlling human perception. And, you know, what they've done, the Rothschilds, brilliantly, is through the 20th century up to now, is they've really, often in the way that the caller describes, hidden the true extent of their power, financial power, never mind power on other levels. In the early part of the 20th century, and in the 1800s, of course, the Rothschilds were recognized as the big powerhouse in banking and global finance. They were exposed for funding both sides in wars to create a conflict, which then allowed them to gain more power. But through the 20th century, particularly the latter half, they've hidden that. And Rothschild's not a name that comes up anything like as much as it used to in terms of finance and stuff. But their power is not only what it was when they were recognized power brokers in finance, etc. It's greater now, and it's more powerful because it's hidden, and people don't see what the true ownership.
Do you think they're
they're
enjoying what's going on now, David? This collapse?
Oh yes, because you know where we started out this chat a few hours ago. Now, we talked about the fact that although there are names like Merrill Lynch and
Lehman Brothers
and all these
Bear Stearns, goodbye.
Their names, right? They're masks on the face, and they're completely expendable because the face is still there. The banking system's still there. It just doesn't. It just a few faces have disappeared. That's all. A few masks have disappeared, rather. And behind, when we talked about if you go higher and higher and higher, the same people control anyway. Whatever the name of the mask is, they still control the system. We're talking the Rothschilds. They are right up there. And so whether this name falls or that name falls, the system as it changes as a result of those crashes, that system is still controlled by the Rothschilds. And if you take the gentleman's example now here with the Bank of America, which he charts through to the Rothschilds, and I've heard this many times before over the years, by the way, about the Bank of America, and the Bank of America's now absorbed Merrill Lynch. So Merrill Lynch has gone, if you like, but the power is still there, and the Bank of America owns it, and the Rothschilds are sitting up there, and the system is moving about and causing great disruption at the human level, the population level, but at their level, they're just getting more and more and more power.
And they've been around for at least 300 years, at least, huh?
Yes, and there's two stories to the Rothschilds, which I've followed. One is the expansion of their financial and banking power, and the other one is their black magic power, because the two go together. I mean, they understand, for instance, that like everything, money is an energy, and you can use manipulative techniques of energy to make energy flow to you, in this case in the form of money, and not flow into an area that you don't want it to flow into.
Hey, David, we're going to take some final calls, but we'll take this break. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, it's been a while, but Red Elk joins us. We're going to talk about his prophecies and also the prophecies of the Hopis through the eyes of Red Elk. We'll be back with Final Calls with David Icke in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with David Icke. Let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going, first of all, to Sean in Cincinnati. Go ahead, Sean. Thanks for holding.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
We're well. Thanks.
All right. My question is this. If we view everything in a 3D perception in a reality, how is it that we are able to view things in a different reality, let's say like a four dimension or another perception? Because when the pilgrims first came over to the Indians could see the ships or couldn't see the ships on the ocean for weeks until they came on shore. And then all of a sudden they could see the ships because they appeared visible to them because they knew what they were. So if we can't see things around us because we're unable to visibly see them, how do we change our perception to view from a three-dimensional view in order to see it another perception?
Yeah, this is a really interesting point, and what we're talking about here is the decoding mechanism of the brain mind that we were talking about earlier. In the same way that the guy Tom in that example I gave couldn't see his daughter because he wasn't bringing that through into a decoded three-dimensional, apparently three-dimensional form. So the example you give is the same principle, and often we don't see things. I mean, I remember talking to Kreda Mutwa, the Zulu shaman and the official historian of the Zulu nation, and I said to him, if these reptilians exist, which he talks about too, he calls them the Chitahuri, the children of the serpent, how come we don't see more of them? And he said, because there's a blind spot in the brain that won't see them, filters them out. And it's like when something is so fantastic sometimes that the brain can't conceive it from its program reality, then it simply won't read that field, it won't read that program, and therefore it won't bring it into holographic form. But then so you won't see it. But the more you open your consciousness and you move your point of perception and you stop identifying who you are with the reflection in the mirror and start identifying yourself with infinite consciousness, having an experience, the more your mind will expand, and therefore the range of frequencies will be greater than they were before. Not just in visual frequencies, but in perception frequencies. You see things around you in terms of events and situations that you didn't see before. It's like another level opens up to you. But of course, you know, there's so much more about this whole process of what is this reality and how do we decode it? Why don't we decode this? Why don't we decode that? That we don't know yet. That's the journey that I'm on to try to understand more about it. And I haven't got all the answers yet, for sure.
Okay, thank you for that. Next up, let's go to New Orleans. Hey, Stephen, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hey. It's an honor to speak with you, David, and you again as well. But, David, I came across your 2001 edition of And the Truth Shall Set You Free earlier this year on my bookshelf. So oddly, I never purchased it. It was pretty strange. But this discovery occurred about 6 months after a pretty spiritually traumatizing event where I was introduced firsthand to the reality of the secret elite. And really, it's changed my perspective of the world ever since. So I was literally sobbing and terrified when I experienced this. And I'm a little nervous talking about it. But thanks to your research, I've kind of lost that fear, and I'm trying to find a way to work my life with that awareness now. But coincidentally, and I think it's pretty more symbolic, though, that I moved to a new apartment, and I live like three blocks away from a Masonic cemetery, and it's really weird. But I have one question, though, if I may.
Sure.
And I think it's pretty important. But first, I want to personally thank you for the very real empowerment that you provide to people. And I've definitely been in need of the empowerment that you've provided, so I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much.
Definitely. But I have one question. So I have no trouble believing that McCain is aware of this Luciferian agenda that you write about.
Right.
But what do you think are the motivations behind Barack Obama? Or is he like you speak of John Kennedy, where it's more like his political circle that's working the Luciferian agenda? And if you can comment about Dr. Rudolf Steiner as well and his significance to this picture.
Well, don't start me off about Barack Obama, please, because we've only got 20 minutes left and you know, I would have a lot to say. But Barack Obama is one of the most monumental windbags and frauds, most blatant ones that I've come across. You know, again, when you move your point of perception, you see things that you wouldn't normally see. And when I see him speak, I see the rehearsal. I see the rehearsal where he looks at certain times. I see the rehearsal in the way he delivers it. And what I see is monumental ungenuineness. And then you look into his background, and you find this guy, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Brzezinski was the man who, a few years ago in a Paris magazine, admitted that when he was National Security Advisor for the Carter administration, he set out to encourage and lure the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan because he said he wanted to give the other superpower their Vietnam. It cost 1 million lives in Afghanistan, that invasion. And that was not a problem to him, it seemed, in the interview when he was asked about that, because lack of empathy, lack of empathy with the consequences of others of his actions. He also said that the way he one key way that he tried to lure the Soviet Union into Afghanistan was before the invasion to start to fund rebels in Afghanistan to resist the Soviet controlled government in Kabul. When the invasion arrived from the Soviet Union, these rebels became known as the Mujahideen, and after the invasion ended, they became known as the Taliban and what is called Al Qaeda, although that's nothing like what it's claimed to be. And Al Qaeda, according not only to researchers like me, but according to the former British Foreign Secretary, a man called Robin Cook, who wrote an article about this, Al-Qaeda means the database, the base or the database, and it comes from the database of Mujahideen fighters that the CIA held, who they were funding and training to meet this, to cause disruption for the Soviet Union in Afghanistan.
With bin Laden there as well, right?
Well, yes, one of the key things, George, they did was at one point that another 51st state of the United States, Saudi Arabia, provided this front man, this focus, Osama bin Laden, for that resistance to the Soviet invasion. So here we're talking about a man who is openly admitting that he basically started this train of events and consciously did it, and a man who has written books about the desire for a centralized state of the kind that I have described in this interview. And he's the man behind Barack Obama. Barack Obama is like all of them. He's a front man. He's a shell. And what he's doing is selling himself, I think, blatantly, but then again, I'm one step back from it, blatantly selling himself into office. And he's just a front man for the same force. Now, in the end, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a co-founder of the Trilateral Commission, a major group of manipulating organization in the web, particularly in America, but worldwide too, in Europe and Japan, etc. He eventually locks in, if you go high enough, into the same force that controls the neocon network that has controlled Bush and is behind McCain. So whichever one you get, the same force is going to be in power. The government changes, but the control does not.
They've hedged their bets, haven't they?
Yes, and the thing is that what they've tried to sell people with Obama is this thing about change. Now, if you go back, I mean, if he says change again, I'll do something. But if you go back to Clinton in 92, his election campaign was change. I stand for change. I stand for change. I stand for change. Why? It's very effective, this, because the way the system manipulates society, at any point in time, most people are not happy with their status quo because of the way society works.
Right.
And therefore, anyone that comes along and says change is very people are very open to that because they don't like the status quo. Yeah, change. I'll have change. We need change. And then, of course, they get into office and nothing changes. In fact, the only thing that will change...
Until the next guy comes in and says we want change.
Exactly.
Right?
The only change that will happen is if Obama gets in is change along the direction to the Orwellian global state.
All right. Well, that's pretty dramatic stuff, David. Scott, trucking around in Orlando. Go ahead, Scott.
Wow. Thank you very much, George. I appreciate the opportunity. David, it's a great honor to speak with you. I've been a tremendous student, supporter, and someone who tries to share your work with others. You've really pulled things together for me the last several years.
Thank you very much.
Yes, David. I've been on the journey, spiritual journey, for quite a long time. But one thing I could never accept, David, was the nature of so-called evil. That was a very hard sticking point for me. 9/11 did it for me to realize that our leaders could do something of that nature just really blew the door wide open and pulled it all together. And you have articulated what I felt for a long time. So with that said, just wanted to elaborate on the characteristic of lack of empathy.
Correct.
and how the DNA interface supports that characteristic, because I have a personal dilemma understanding it, because I have a brother who is a biological brother who exhibits these traits, and I've tried to examine it with him, and he throws up the classic Doors. You know, he don't want to go there. But mm-hmm. he has displayed these characteristics throughout his life, but yet we share the same DNA. So I struggle with understanding how that interface operates.
Well, I would put it this way. On my computer in the office next door, I have a great bank of files, my documents, whatever you want to call it, on the hard drive. And they're all potential. They're all potential files to come on the screen. But if I don't open them, then they don't appear on the screen. They don't appear in my reality. And DNA has infinite potential. And, of course, the nature of some DNA means there is far more potential for certain files to be opened than there is in other DNA. But all the files are there to be opened. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is how these people, these network of families, they use ritual, which they've been using for thousands of years for a simple reason. It works to open certain files in their children. And this is why the children are put through these ritualistic situations in early in life and more and more as they grow up. And what they're doing in these rituals is teasing open these particular files to manifest in the behavior and perception and attitudes of the children, so they become people with a lack of empathy and a lack of ability to empathize with become cold-blooded, we would call him. And it's all DNA has this potential. Some has more potential, but you can be of this DNA bloodline. And I've met loads of people like this. Those files have not been opened, so they don't manifest in those people in their lack of empathy. I've met people from some of these families who do have empathy. I've met a heck of a lot who don't, but who do have of empathy. And it's all about manipulating the files that are open and the files that are closed. And somebody might have some experience in their childhood that will open a file and manifest as behavior or whatever. There's so much more to know about this that we don't know, but. It's like having the potential, and what's open opens and affects behavior. What's closed doesn't affect behavior, at least conscious behavior.
Okay, thank you, David. Hawaii we go. Brian, you're up. Go ahead, Bri.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, aloha, David. I will talk fast. I guess we are. We're kind of running out of time here. My question is this, and I want to explain why I'm asking the question is, can you see the galactic codes? Because I can see them. And I can see them, and I can read them, and I can pretty much read the multi-level alien languages.
And
I can explain to you how I first came across these codes. I randomly come across, I guess, what you would call a rift or a tear in the 3D realm. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But it's actually just a hologram, so it's flat, a flat screen in a sense. You know, and it almost seems as if, like, the left side and, like, I was staring at the flat screen, and it almost appeared like it was a hidden wall, like as if the left side of the wall was 3 feet set back from the right side of the wall, like that the hologram wasn't exactly flat. And I kind of peeked around the corner, and I could see these light body aliens with these weird thought reality processing computer machines.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks odd, and it looks almost like a tinker toy made of lights and weird computer chip celluline structure. However, I don't know, is there anyone out there that actually sees these things like I do and can actually read this weird alien language and see these codes, these malevolent codes, like, being spun out?
Okay, we've got only a few minutes left.
Well, if the gentleman could contact me through my website, I would be very, very interested to talk to you at more length about this. This fits the basic principles of what you're talking about fits absolutely the way, at least at one level of this whole computer game, that I do see it, not see it literally like him, but see it in my perception. And, you know, at one level, this reality is digital. We're decoding it into this physical reality we think we're experiencing. And so when you look at the Matrix movies, they were looking on those computer screens at moving green codes. But what they were seeing was street scenes and landscapes and people and cars and everything, because that was symbolic of this whole decoding system I'm talking about. And I thought for a while, a long time, are we in a prison reality that was created as a prison reality? Or is this a realm of experience for consciousness, which at least in this region of it has been hijacked? And I think it's the latter. I think the decoding system has been hijacked. I think what we heard about many times through history and ancient accounts about the manipulation of human genetics, I think that's manipulation of the human computer to reduce the range of frequencies that it can access. And I think we've been putting a vibrational prison by manipulation of this digital and vibrational matrix that we are experiencing in what we think is 3D. And that's where we need to get to understand this. That's where the projection's coming from. And we need to get there if the movie is going to change.
David, we're in for some interesting, fascinating, and somewhat frightening times, are we not?
We're in for some interesting times. Whether they're frightening or not depends on our relationship to them. I'm not in the least bit frightened, and I'll tell you why. Because when people talk about what it's like when they leave the body, when they leave this telescope that holds us in this five-sense reality, they talk about extraordinary levels of bliss, awareness, connection, you know. So fear is just what we're experiencing in this reality. You know, it's not what the multi-leveled life is really about. It's an experience, and if we see it like that, we can take it like that and not let it consume us, control us, and overwhelm us.
Once again, David, thank you so much. David Icke, again, is going to be at the Bay Area UFO Expo the end of September. I'll be there as well. Information on the coasttocoastam.com website. Go to his website, information, when he comes to Los Angeles on October 1st. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Audisour, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punted and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.